Georgia's senior citizen population is 40,000 and growing, but it's been reported there are less than 7 general physicians taking on new Medicare patients. And even those who have been hard to find, if not impossible. This means there are many elders among us who have medical issues going unheeded. Even those who have additional insurance coverage are finding they cannot be seen by a general practitioner, as Medicare is their primary insurer. Not being able to be seen by a general practitioner also means not being able to get a referral to any needed specialist. This problem has not gone unnoticed by medical professionals and politicians in the state, and this year some solutions are beginning to form. Hello, I'm Tika Ballas, and today on Hometown Alaska, my guests and I are going to be discussing what is available and what is becoming available to our senior citizens. With us today is Dr. Thomas Hunt. He is the Chief Executive Officer for Physician Services of Providence Health and Services Alaska. Formerly a staff physician at the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, he has held the position of Medical Director at the Health Center from 2001 until early last year. His ties to the Anchorage community also extend to serving as Medical Director for Anchorage Project Access and as Medical Advisor for the Home Health Program at Providence. Welcome to the show, Tom. Also with us is Dr. Anthral, a nurse practitioner for the Palliative Care Consultation Service at Providence. She holds a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, a Master's of Science, Doctorate of Nursing Practice, and is board certified in geriatrics and palliative care. Welcome to the show, Anne.
Thank you, Tika.
And again, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Today we're discussing the Medicare conundrum, how Anchorage residents on Medicare can seek and find the medical attention they need. If you have questions for my guests or would like to add your 2 cents to the conversation, please give us a call at 550-8433, 550-8433, or email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. Now, there are some links to some helpful sites on our website where you can also stream this show at kska.org. Now, Medicare is a hot topic around the nation, and many different issues concerning Medicare have been discussed right here on KSKA this past couple of weeks. You can listen to those past shows on our website as well. Today, we're going to look specifically at what those needs are, what options are available, and how and where Anchorage senior citizens can find them. But first, let's just start the show by quickly framing the issue from a professional standpoint. Tom, tell us what's going on with Medicare in Alaska and why it is so much worse here than just about any place else in the nation.
It's not dramatically worse than any other place in the nation, but it is worse, and there are several reasons. One is that there's a lack of primary care physicians in Alaska, and in Anchorage, we estimate that the Anchorage Bowl could justify having another 10 to 15 general primary care physicians, more than we currently have at the moment. A few of those are seeing Medicare for primary care purposes. Access to specialty care isn't quite as dire. The reason that there are fewer primary care physicians has mostly to do with the nature of graduate medical education in the lower 48, and it's hard to turn out enough physicians in primary care specialties, dominantly internal medicine and family medicine. And then it's hard to attract those physicians up to Alaska. And then the issue becomes one of finances. If you're a busy internist here in Anchorage, you have a choice. You can see the many, many, many people needing an internist who have commercial insurance, or you could try to work in some Medicare patients. There's a significant gap in the revenue between the two classes. And by the end of the day, if an internist or family physician sees a dominant proportion of Medicare, the income's going to come close to not meeting overhead. And so many physicians in town have chosen to either opt out or not see Medicare patients altogether. Others have chosen to keep those Medicare patients that they already had, but not take any new ones. And so it's largely a financial issue, but there are other layers as well. One being that as we age, we become more complex physiologically, medically, socially. And so the time requirement to see a complex elder with multiple medical problems increases, and then the dollars per minute spent becomes an unfavorable ratio, and after a while, you begin to see the writing on the wall, and it's just as easy to not see the Medicare patients. The other concern that physicians have is a fear of audit. One of Medicare's tools for maintaining solvency, such as they are solvent, is to seek fraud or waste. And so there's a great deal of oversight of physician practice. And that becomes onerous and something that physicians fear. And so they, if they could avoid having that sort of oversight, they'll choose to do so. And then the third issue is that complex chronic patients require a lot of work in between visits. So whereas one might not see a patient for 3 months or 6 months or even 12 months, there's a lot that happens in between the visit. And in fee-for-service reimbursement, the way we're accustomed to it in the United States, we're really only paid for the visit time, not for those phone calls, the care coordination, the refilling medications, authorizing durable equipment needs like diapers or feeding tubes or whatever the need might be. There's a lot that happens. And it's estimated that you can spend as much time in between a visit as during a visit to care for a complex patient. And none of that, of course, is reimbursable. So between the lack of physicians, the lower reimbursements, the demand from other commercial payers to occupy yourself with well-paying patients, and then finally the oversight concern and the time in between visits, it all adds up to a crisis. It's a perfect storm.
And this perfect storm is that way we're starting to see some changes come about here in the Anchorage area then?
Well, fortunately, most of us in the community recognize that this is a problem, and it's a problem of respect, it's a problem of access, it's a problem of compassion. It's also a medical nightmare because there are a lot of patients out there who aren't getting the care they need, preventive or otherwise, and will inevitably enter the medical system one way or another. And so if not cared for proactively in the primary care setting, they'll enter the system through emergency care, hospital care, or other urgent care systems, because ultimately we can't forestall their illnesses forever. And so it's bollocksing up the entire system. And so everybody recognizes that we need to increase our access to primary care. So there have been a number of efforts to alleviate this over the years. Most famously recently, when Senator Stevens arranged for an increased reimbursement for primary care clinicians seeing Medicare. And that was, I'm guessing, in 2007 or 8. It lasted for about 12 to 18 months. It wasn't clear that it really changed physician behavior. There wasn't a really precise follow-up study to see whether a little extra money would make a difference in behavior. And that's why I point out that it's not just the money, it's the oversight, it's the hassle factor that impedes physicians' willingness to see them. So in the last few years, retired Anchorage cardiologist Dr. George Rainier took it upon himself to create a Medicare access program. They've created something called the Alaska Medicare Clinic. They now have space in South Anchorage, still working on finding the physician staff. They did get some funding from the legislature and other sources, and their goal was to try to offer a Medicare access point for primary care. Meanwhile, the Providence Community Mission Board asked that Providence institute its own primary care system for Medicare. We call this the Providence Senior Care Center, and that's now open for 3 weeks.
3 weeks. And how many patients on general? I mean, are you seeing like a huge throw of people coming to the doors? Or
we have a wait list. But let me, before I lose the opportunity to mention, there are still physicians in town who are seeing Medicare. There are nurse practitioners who are practicing independently or seeing Medicare, urgent care systems who will see them, albeit not for primary care. And then finally, the residency here with Providence is seeing a limited amount of Medicare. And the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center is really probably the hero in all of this because they're now seeing up to 35% of their population being Medicare, approaching that number.
Well, let's just go back to one thing that you said, though, about the nurse practitioners. There is this overall idea, I think, for a lot of people that a nurse practitioner is not a real doctor, and not seeing your real doctor means you're not getting the proper care. Now, can we explain for some of those listeners exactly what a nurse practitioner does that's the same as a doctor, Anne?
Well, nurse practitioners in the state of Alaska can diagnose illness and treat illness, write prescriptions, and even write prescriptions for narcotics if they're required. And so there are several nurse practitioners practicing independently and doing those very things. For more complex issues, they have a physician or many physicians to whom they refer patients out so that they are not managing things that really are beyond their scope of practice.
And that's a big issue for Medicare patients who haven't been able to find a general practitioner and perhaps should be finding at least a nurse practitioner to be referred to specialists, correct?
Correct.
And so for people who have like ailments that require a specialist of sorts, this is something that like the new clinics, the two new clinics will be able to provide as well, is sending them over to specialists. Does that mean that specialists are going to see a larger influx of patients now, do you think, or?
No, I don't think so. First of all, before I forget on nurse practitioners, Medicare doesn't recognize a nurse practitioner's work as valuable as a physician. And so for a given service, a nurse practitioner is paid 85% of the physician fee. So there are many heroes in the nurse practitioner community here who are, in fact, trying to fill this Medicare access problem. And they do so not just at the usual penalty, but at 85% of the usual penalty. So credit to them.
Yeah.
Now, the nurse practitioners can do a fabulous job of primary care. And we rely on them a great deal, especially out in rural Alaska, where physician assistants and NPs provide really the backbone of the primary care delivery system. Now, will allowing more Medicare patients access to primary care result in more specialty referrals? To some degree, I think that's accurate. But remember, those patients are accessing the medical system one way or another. The cardiologists will tell you that they're managing the primary care needs of their cardiac Medicare patients all the time. They just don't have anywhere to place that patient into a primary care home to get the coordinated needs met. And so the cardiologist or the oncologist, the urologist, I've heard it from all of my specialty colleagues, will reluctantly prescribe medicines beyond their specialty because that patient has no access to other sources to coordinate it all. One other interesting fact is that the average Medicare beneficiary sees five specialists nationally.
Five specialists within a year?
On a given year, the average Medicare recipient sees five specialists.
Is that excessive?
It speaks to the complexity of the care. And so as a primary care clinician, whether nurse practitioner or physician or otherwise, that clinician needs to interface not just with the patient, but with up to five or more specialists and all the durable equipment manufacturers or suppliers who might be supplying their wheelchairs or oxygen supplies or diapers, and also with hospital personnel and radiology or laboratory personnel. And so the number of contacts per beneficiary by a primary care clinician approaches 100 per year per beneficiary. And this has been well mapped out. And it speaks to one of the challenges that primary care has is if you have to do 100 phone calls or emails or fax management per patient per year, imagine all the time that consumes in between the visit. Because none of that happens in the context of your short visit, right? And so this speaks to what Dr. Rainier's Alaska Medicare Clinic has structured their system around, which is to recognize that the only way to actually get ahead and make a viable practice model if you're going to dedicate your resources to Medicare patients is to limit the work that you do in between visits and do only what you're paid to do, which again is sort of a minority of the total amount of care that's required, but it's realistic. And so if you know, credit to him and his team and his board, they're trying to create a viable business model, but the only way to do that is to provide a relatively limited scope of services today and then make the patient come back in the next time that the patient needs some level of service so that they can be paid for the work that they do.
Now, the other day, Tom, you were on Line One and you mentioned something about a way to cut the cost in some sense and have a more viable clinic was to have more nurse practitioners and aides doing a lot of the paperwork aspect of like asking familial background questions, where were you out of country, et cetera. And, but yet a primary complaint by patients all over, whether Medicare or not, is that they don't get enough one-on-one time with their doctor. And it sounds like that's been acknowledged in the elderly community right now. But how does, say, at Providence within the Medicare clinic, how are they looking to still get quality one-on-one with each visit if a lot of that time is spent with a practitioner?
Well, it's a wonderful question. Because they're saying this, I believe, that they don't get enough time with their doctor because they're not getting enough time in total. And the assumption is that the doctor is the only person who can do any and all healthcare services. And a lot of work, very innovative work, has been done around teams to deliver the total care. In fact, in town at South Central Foundation, they've built a highly recognized innovative treatment team concept where the physician's role is only one of a large number of people who touch that patient during any visit. And this is something that we're going to ourselves. It's the scope of services that we can provide a patient on any given day should and could include behavioral health interventions, social work interventions, simple preventive care interventions, like getting their flu shots or mammograms arranged, to general health coaching. And there's no reason, frankly, that the physician has to do all of that. In fact, we've pretty well proven that physicians aren't very good at doing a lot of that. We are not good health coaches. We are not good dietitians. We are not good at remembering the preventive care interventions that we're supposed to deliver. We forget all the time because we're distracted by the acute problem in front of us. We're certainly not good social workers. And so when we create teams who can touch that patient on a given day, patients do get satisfied. And they don't expect, actually, that their time with the doctor was short because they got their needs met. And so patient satisfaction and integrated systems like that tends to run higher than they'll ever run in a practice that really has to rely on the 15-minute visit.
Right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing the medical care available to Medicare patients in Anchorage. And there are a lot of different things that are becoming available for the first time, some things that have been there for a short period. But we also have here on the line with us is Les Guerra. He's calling in from the state capitol, and he's currently following a bill he's drafted, HB 152. Welcome to the show, Les.
Thanks, Tika, for having me.
Oh, no, thank you for being here. Can you tell us just a little bit about this bill?
Sure. You know, one of the problems of Medicare has been that with the inadequate reimbursement for some specialties, mostly primary care, nobody's allowed to supplement that payment. So you go to a doctor, the reimbursement isn't enough to get the doctor to see you. You're not allowed to supplement it. Your insurance company's not allowed to supplement it. Not like your insurance company would, but they're not allowed to. And the state's not allowed to supplement it. And so what you have is a system that says the doctor has to take the Medicare payment, just that, and nothing more, and except for the copay. And in Alaska, for some reason, and it's complex, the Medicare reimbursement rates have been set pretty low for office visits. And so you have a lot of doctors now not taking Medicare patients, We started to work on this problem maybe 2 years ago to try and find some way the state could participate. And we early on found out the state can't supplement the Medicare payment. And so we started working with Senator Begich's office. And he got a provision put through in the Federal Health Care Act last year that in a certain way allows the state to now start a grant program. And so today, the state can supplement the Medicare payment. The grant program has to be very carefully worded. And Senator French and I have said, okay, we're allowed to do it now. Let's do it. It's not like the Medicare crisis is disappearing. Thanks to Providence Hospital for starting a Medicare clinic. Thanks to Dr. Rainier for starting a Medicare clinic. Thanks to the neighborhood health centers for taking in Medicare patients. But the bottom line is we still have a crisis out there. And the state can help solve it or the state can duck its head in the sand. You know, we hear a lot in around the Capitol about keeping government small. But there's a difference between keeping government small and keeping government unengaged. And right now, the government, the state government, is unengaged in the Medicare problem.
Great. And so this bill currently has been drafted and it's before the House?
Yes, it's in Wes Keller's Health and Human Services Committee on the House side. On the Senate side, it is in Senator Betty Davis's Health and Human Services Committee.
Great. And on our website at kska.org under Hometown Alaska, you'll see that we also have the link so that you can follow this bill. Again, this is HB 152. And again, thank you, Les Guerra, for joining the conversation today and letting us know a little bit about that.
Sure.
And we also have with us today, who's also called in, we're looking at all the different options that are available to Medicare patients in this area, as well as the entire state. We've just heard a little bit about a bill that's going through the House. We are also discussing today here with our guest what's available already in place here in Anchorage and the two new clinics that are coming into fruition here. But we also have on the phone somebody who might be able to answer some questions for people out there. Jenna Larson is here from the Medicare Foundation. How are you, Jenna?
Hi, it's Janae.
Oh, Janae, my apologies.
That's okay, no worries.
And go ahead, sorry.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on today. I'm actually staffed in the Health and Social Services for the state of Alaska, and we received two federal grants to help educate Medicare beneficiaries in Alaska through the SHIP program. That's the State Health Insurance Program. And that's to help Medicare beneficiaries understand their options or solve their problems or inquiries with Medicare. And then the other grant that we have is through the Administration on Aging, and that is to help protect Medicare against fraud, waste, abuse, and error through the SMP, Senior Medicare Patrol.
And is that, when you speak of fraud, is this what we were discussing earlier with Tom, where he mentioned a big problem for physicians is dealing with the fraud oversight?
Yeah, every $1 of $10 billed to Medicare is fraudulent. So there's a big push in, well, the SMP program has been around for some time, and that's senior volunteers who are out there educating Medicare beneficiaries or trying to fight Medicare fraud. And now with the healthcare reform, even more actions are going to be taken to try to prevent fraudulent billing or to help educate beneficiaries of reading their Medicare summary notices or questioning what's going on out there and what's going on with their health care.
And tell me this as well. Like I've been hearing more and more about this recently, that elderly patients need to be more aware of having physician, this push and pull and this fraud to the patient themselves? Is this something you're aware of here, or is this just something out in the ethers that I've been hearing about?
Well, we don't experience the level of fraud in Alaska, or at least it's not being reported. We're finding here in Alaska at the levels there are in places like Florida and California. And that could be that because there's more of an elderly population in those areas, or it could just be that since we have this doctor shortage going on, persons are also reluctant to report even a concern that maybe might be an accident, a misbill. because they're worried about losing the valuable relationship that they have with their doctor or facility. So, but we don't see the level of fraud here in Alaska that we do in some of the other states in the nation. But we do want to educate persons of how to be aware of their Medicare summary notices. These are the notices that come from Medicare of how a claim was paid, because it can also not necessarily be a fraudulent thing by the doctors or facilities. It could be identity theft, somebody, a person taking their Medicare number or their health insurance card and using it to access medical services that a person actually didn't receive themselves.
Wow. And tell me this, for what kind of referrals do you make there to people who are either new to Medicare or new to the state with Medicare? If they're seeking a physician, what kind of referrals can you make to them?
Well, we actually don't recommend one doctor over another, so we don't make referrals in the sense that we would personally say, we know this physician and they're wonderful, or, you know, we know this clinic and they you know, provide services to the elderly population. We try to just educate persons. We're always unbiased information as far as what we're trying to provide the beneficiary. We're really working on behalf of the beneficiaries or their caregivers or family members. And so most of the time what we're advising is tools that they can use to locate Medicare-approved providers like Medicare.gov or our website, which is Medicare.alaska.gov. We do advise them of the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center because with the shortage, that's one of the clinics that we do know will accept Medicare patients. And we do educate persons about the new Medicare clinics opening up because with the access issue, it is hard to try to find someone that will accept a new Medicare patient. But we also educate a beneficiary that they may be able to get in with a doctor or facility that has a family member that's already treating them, kind of have grandfathered rights, no pun intended, or to try to look into nurse practitioners who may be willing to take patients and treat for primary care. So we try to help them to get creative in such an access issue. And it's simply using the tools out there to find who's in the Medicare network, or just telling them to look in the phone book, and they do have to call around and see if anyone will accept them as a new patient because it is the choice of the facility or doctor whether they want to accept a patient or not, if their clinic is already full, if they're not accepting Medicare, those kinds of things.
Great. And as Janae mentioned, those websites, those again are on our website as well, on kska.org under Hometown Alaska. You'll see that we have a number of links, both to the clinic or the clinics, and as mentioned, the Medicare offices here in state in Anchorage. We're going to be right back after this break, and we're going to discuss some further issues concerning the elderly population here in the Anchorage area and some of the resources that are available to them.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to the show. If you're just tuning in, this is Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing the medical care available to Medicare patients in Anchorage. If you have specific questions for one of our guests, where to go, how to get there, how to find it, then please call in. If you've got a question that means somebody else probably does too. The number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. or you can email us your questions and comments at hometownalaska@kska.org. Our website, there is a list of links to some helpful organizations, as well as links to shows from the past couple of weeks concerning Medicare and the new Medicare clinics opening up. That's at kska.org under Hometown Alaska. Now, before we go back into this whole discussion, I would like to point out and not leave out the Medicare beneficiaries who are not senior citizens. Tom, perhaps you can explain just a little bit who Medicare covers and who the recipients there are.
Medicare covers the elderly, defined in government speak as 65 or older, but also people who are disabled and or who have chronic renal failure. So nationally, 18% of Medicare beneficiaries are less than 65.
18%?
18%. And they may be brain injured as a young adult. They could have been, they could have congenital birth defects as a young child and moved to Medicare, frankly, from early childhood.
So will both of the two new clinics cover all Medicare or just those who are 65 or older?
I can't speak for Dr. Rainier's efforts as to whether they'll accept younger Medicare. Ours has a 55-year and up age group cutoff, and so we've defined ourselves as caring for the senior Medicare.
Okay. And now I just want to turn this conversation just a little bit to discuss some other different types of care out there. There is the clinic, or rather the two clinics coming up, but we also have what's available here in Anchorage called palliative care, and I think there's a lot of confusion as to the difference between hospice and palliative care. Can you explain a little bit about the difference?
Absolutely. There is a great deal of confusion about exactly what palliative care is. And certainly palliative care came about after patients in the 80s and 90s were concerned because they felt that they weren't getting good care in hospitalizations, especially pain control management, information sharing, decision making, and all of those kinds of aspects of being in the hospital and being ill. And so palliative care came about really in the last, it's really taken off in about the last 10 years or so. It is a service that can be approached at the day of diagnosis of any chronic illness, whether it be heart disease or lung disease or any neurodegenerative disease, dementia. And it really deals with primarily the quality of a person's life during that illness experience. And it obviously deals with symptom management, making people as comfortable as they can be, and really helping them plan for later stages of illness. Now, we consider ourselves sort of non-hospice palliative care. However, palliative care is truly practiced in a hospice as well, of course, because symptom management and information and taking care of the patient in all aspects of care is very important during that time.
And as I understand, though, at least at Providence, where you're doing palliative care, the majority of your patients are inpatient.
Yes, approximately 90% of our patients are inpatients at this time.
So how does that break up the definition, though, of hospice? I think the understanding of hospice, too, is the living with it, with the practitioner.
Hospice services take place at home or in the patient's home as defined by them. Could be assisted living, could be at home. And it is a service that is intermittent, but they are available 24/7 for any crises that comes up. They help the person who is ill be comfortable. They help the family adjust and really provide a great deal of assistance and education about caregiving at this time of life. And so it's a service that takes place in a home setting, not in the hospital setting.
By definition, to those who are actively dying.
Exactly. The definition is really if the person is expected to die within the next 6 months, they are a candidate for hospice care.
And that is the difference right there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you say that with most of the people in palliative care here, they're inpatient. And does that mean that they're going to be there for a long duration until the end of their lives, or is that just a temporary setting, or how does that work?
Well, it's for patients who will be in the hospital for a period of time, and these days it isn't very long before they have to, that they get discharged. And so primarily we get consulted, well, we get consulted for many different reasons. Sometimes it's pain management, because pain management is a very complex thing. It isn't a visit by the physician or the provider in the morning, and then they don't see them till the next day. It's really an ongoing sort of assessment of what's happening, and is the intervention working? Is the person feeling better? And so it takes place on a 24-hour basis.
And how can that possibly happen if you're not inpatient then?
If you're not inpatient?
Yeah.
Well, certainly there are many providers in the community that do a good job of palliative care. They do take good care of their patients, and they do make them pain and symptom free. So that can happen. In the community, typically in the hospital setting, for example, we see patients, and it's fairly easy to develop a regimen for them which is satisfactory, i.e. they're comfortable. And so that regimen can continue out into the community. We do follow a few patients as outpatients who have been in the hospital just to make sure that we can amend the plan of care as need be so that they remain comfortable.
Now, I know you and I discussed earlier that you're not necessarily completely involved with the Medicare aspect of it, but my understanding is Medicare does cover palliative care?
Medicare and other insurances do cover palliative care, yes.
And do you have to be referred in order to obtain palliative care?
Yes. Palliative care can be consulted by the attending physician or sometimes a specialist who is taking care of a patient in the hospital and they would like some additional assistance. And so it is always physician referred.
And part of the reason palliative care is covered is that it's a good investment. When we manage our patient's symptoms, they tend not to be rehospitalized as often. They tend not to seek emergency care. They tend not to mess up their medicines because they're pain-racked and unable to keep things straight. So it's a good investment. The other thing that makes it a good investment is the emphasis they place on planning for the end of life. Different somewhat from hospice in that we've already established we're in the end-of-life process. They're early on in palliative care in the disease process, and can help that patient manage, expect, anticipate, prepare for life limitations and ultimate death from this condition. And by doing a good job up front, they can avoid that whole recurrent hospitalization game, which in the long run is what's really charging up the Medicare bill.
Right.
Because we spend so much money on the last 30 days of life. That if we could avoid even some of that spend, we would have a great deal more for the primary care to do it right in the first place.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. This is the end-of-life counseling that has been renamed all kinds of different things, but let's just call it what it is. And tell us, in your definition, estimation, what exactly is end-of-life counseling? What does it entail? And what can a patient expect out of end-of-life counseling?
Yeah. So patients who have chronic illness like to have some control, as they should. And so part of that control can be manifest by planning for the end of life, whenever that may be coming, whether it is a month away or 3 years away. We just don't know. And so end-of-life counseling can take place during a palliative care consultation. We talk about what the disease trajectory might look like, how long a person might expect to live, and so planning that needs to be done can be started at least during that period of time. I think I like to say that there is the emotional part of being sick or having a long-term illness, and there's the business part of that. And certainly thinking about advanced directives and what a person wants is the business part, like paying your taxes, like creating a will for your possessions. It's a different kind of a will or a legacy.
So what is the big hoopla over this then? Why is there... If that's all it is it about this is brand new to people, or is it because it's the first time that Medicare may cover it?
That's a really good question, and I'm sort of confounded by that as well. Again, I think it is a person's another way of controlling what happens in your life, because certainly there are a lot of things about illness that are out of control. And so to me, it gives a person satisfaction to know that at the end of their life, whenever that may be, they will not have a lot of added burden of technology that they didn't really want. And when I say technology, I'm talking about being placed on a ventilator when that's really not what they wanted, or being placed on a ventilator if that's what they did want. It is their sort of call about what should happen. And so it's really an important, to me, it's a really important feature of being ill.
Now, explain then what is different. I know that there has been some movement with the end-of-life counseling in the new healthcare bill. Have you seen any effects of that currently?
I personally have not, because we just consider this a part of what we do day to day. It's always been that way in the palliative care service, and it probably will continue. So it's just a part of good care for people.
Well, you know, they say that even bad press is good press. And I think just because it's had a lot of like back and forth on end-of-life counseling, I think people are starting to understand that it even exists for the first time. So do you see even in that regard people coming forward and requesting it, or not requesting it but making note of it for the first time, or...
I don't know if I could speak to that for the first time or if there's an added interest, because most of the people that I'm familiar with or that we consult on are already ill. But everybody has that question in the back of their mind, what's going to happen or what should happen or what do I want? And sometimes it's those unexpressed fears or desires or really a need for much more information about what end of life might look like.
So let me be clear about this, that say, for instance, hypothetically, I'm seeing my physician in a professional setting, and I want to discuss with somebody without having to go into the means of like a living will that, you know, I need a hip surgery and I'm worried that if I don't come out of it such and such way, please just untie the tubes. Does that... doctor then is that their responsibility to know this information, to have this information on hand, and to convey this information to my family members?
It's a very long and difficult discussion sometimes. And so having that take place in a pre-op visit, let's say, with a surgeon or really is a difficult task to undertake in that short period of time. Hopefully, people are addressing that before they have to go in for hip surgery, shall we say. But it's something that should be a part of a general medical visit. Physicians and providers need to know what the expectation is of a person who has an illness or surgery or whatever.
Yeah. I think any communication is generally better than no communication whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so for, say, a young person like you approaching a hip surgery, a simple communication about what your aspirations would be, should there be complications, is entirely appropriate. It gives us guidance at the other end when faced with a complex medical decision or appoint a surrogate to do that. So having a conversation to get some communication out is better than avoiding the conversation. Now, that said, these are somewhat imperfect tools. The advance directive paperwork that most of us see are check boxes specifying interventions that most people don't understand. You know, the nature of a ventilator in an intensive care unit is not something that's easily communicated. What it's like to be semi-awake for 48 hours on a vent in a dark ICU room isn't something that we can communicate all that easily. And so we click these buttons sort of in ignorance. So we have to understand that some information isn't necessarily good information, but it's better than no information as a rule.
It does seem surprising to me, to interject my own thought on it, that this isn't just something that happens every time we go into surgery, particularly when we go into more advanced surgeries that have a very 50-50 outcome on them, that this isn't actually something that is required of doctors to have a conversation with somebody or to ensure that they have a living will set in place. Is that not?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because as Providence is on the eve of deploying a large electronic health record, one of the debates that we've had internally is, should the code status, what interventions we do in the event of an emergency, should the code status be mandatory? Will we insist that a physician not be able to enter or leave the chart without designating a code status?
And this is the MyChart that I've been reading about, is that right?
MyChart is part of it, and offers another communication tool. But the inpatient's hospital documentation has a very nice, clear place to clarify what the patient's code status desires would be. But what we haven't chosen to do is insist that the physician actually fill it out.
Oh, minor detail. Again, if you're just tuning in, this is Hometown Alaska, and today my guest and I are discussing Medicare patients and what is available to them here in the Anchorage Bowl area. If you have specific questions or would like to weigh in on this conversation, please by all means give us a call here at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or you can email us your questions and comments at hometownalaska@ksKA.org. We do have an email that has just come in from Ann Zink. As an emergency physician at Matsu, I face the challenges and the consequences of the lack of primary care in the state. The Matsu Valley is like the stepchild of Anchorage, but I think it is important for you and your listeners to know that almost a year ago, our hospital helped sponsor a Medicare-only clinic to help address this issue. The support from the hospital for our most critical patients is key. I am glad to hear Providence has stepped up as well. Thanks again for covering this topic. And can we talk about the psychiatric soon?
Let me thank you. And yes, I'm aware that Matsu Regional did that, and I'm very proud of that effort. One last comment on the advanced directives work. There's a community in Wisconsin, and perhaps you know, is it
Eau Claire?
La Crosse, who had as a community project a campaign to open up the conversation about advanced directives. And it was quite successful. Anne, maybe you could speak to it.
Well, I don't remember statistics, but an enormous number of people in La Crosse, Wisconsin now have advanced directives. And so it was an extremely successful program, and I think it has probably cut down on costs when people go to the hospital. I think it's probably served everyone quite well. It certainly prevents those difficult conversations in the midst of an emergency room visit when a person is suffering in one way or the other. Obviously, if they're in the emergency room, they're there for a reason. And it's a really terrible time to have a conversation about, well, do you want us to put you on a breathing machine? It's just the wrong time, wrong place. And so, yes, those people in La Crosse, Wisconsin are very smart for doing that. So,
psychiatric. Psychiatry and Medicare is a substantial problem.
How so?
There are even fewer psychiatrists than there are primary care physicians in this state. There's a substantially greater need for psychiatrists in this state. This state, ironically or not, has a higher degree of mental illness and substance abuse than other states. And the Medicare population as well. You know, again, when we think of Medicare, and if we only think of grandma, maybe she's not depressed or chemically addicted, but the elders have mental and chemical addiction issues as well. So Medicare is particularly not a good payer in the psychiatry field. And so there are very few access points for Medicare in this community and statewide.
Will the new clinic over at Providence have a behavioral staff member? Or?
That's our aspiration. Once again, it's hard to find staff.
Right. And speaking of staff, how many people do you currently have on staff then?
We have currently two physicians and a nurse practitioner. We are interviewing for others. We're looking for creative ways to fund a behavioral health clinician. Medicare won't pay for many levels of behavioral health clinicians. They'll pay for PhDs and MDs, of course, but a lot of the work in behavioral medicine in the state is done by psychologists of various stripes, licensed psychological counselors, for example. Medicare doesn't recognize them as worthy of being paid. unless there's a psychiatrist in the premise, in the office. And we can't afford to have a psychiatrist in the office at this point. So, yes, we do offer, we will be offering some behavioral health. It's unclear yet what degree, what type, when. Providence does, of course, have a behavioral medicine group. And so we'll be able to refer back and forth inside there, and they are accepting Medicare. Once again, though, the challenge in our behavioral medicine group with Medicare is that those patients are, even if they're entirely happy and well managed by their psychologist, must see a physician psychiatrist every X months. And so you're back to that same narrow part of the funnel again. You need more psychiatrists.
We're going to go ahead to the phones really fast because they're lighting up over here. And welcome to the show, Renee. Hello, Renee.
I'm being an in-home caregiver, and I'm taking care of a diabetic gentleman whose eyesight's in decline, and he has me open his mail for him. And we've run across several times him getting orders for something that they want him to sign so Medicare will pay for it, that he didn't order, and it's not his doctor. And so we've been just throwing them in the garbage. Is there anybody we can report this to?
Well,
how can we contact them?
Yeah, it does seem that Janae, who was just on the show earlier via phone at the Medicare Information Office of Anchorage, is probably a good person to talk to about that. And again, that's on our website at kska.org. We do have a link right on there for that. Thank you for your call, Renee. And we also have Mark on the line. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi. I don't know if you can answer the question, but I have Medicare, and I understand that it's my primary insurance, and then I have some state health insurance. But my physician is doing me a favor by seeing me because she loses money on me. And it's illegal for me to compensate her. It's my understanding, anyway, right, that it's illegal for me to compensate her to the level of her normal fee. And, you know, I can afford that. But I was told that it was that, well, she told me she couldn't accept additional payment. Now, do I understand that correctly?
Yes, you do. Remember, Medicare was born in the Great Society of the late 60s, and the concept was that it would provide equal access to all. And so it's not, it was specifically designed this way, Mark, so that you couldn't buy your way into medical care where your neighbor, who was less well off, couldn't. So the law is very clear. You cannot supplement her bill in any way. And unfortunately, that secondary insurance that you have, neither can it, in most cases, supplement her bill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mark, for joining in on that conversation. And actually, that was another aspect of this whole conversation, is about how you do have a secondary insurance and still are turned away because you have Medicare. And I know that firsthand that is very infuriating for a lot of people, because you think that you've got some backup there, and then you enter the world of Medicare and find out that you don't. Welcome to the show, Julian.
Thank you. You started the program, or Dr. Hunt did, talking about the economics of Medicare, which I understand, and I have sympathy for the doctors, but I also have a different perspective I'd like you to consider. I've seen doctors, in my case, for say 35 or 40 years. I've paid them generously and handsomely. We have the highest paid doctors in the world. I've prepaid. And now many people are being turned away by doctors when they're no longer on an incremental cost base lucrative. But in fact, they've been in the system for 20, 30, 40, or 50 years and have paid generously. I think doctors need to look at the current situation on a long-term basis, just on a short-term basis.
Okay, great. Thank you for weighing in, Julian. Did you have a comment for that? Okay, thank you, Julian. And did you have a comment for that, Tom?
Well, only that in the lower 48, doctors don't earn as much money, it's true. And it's partly because doctors do earn more that we have a well-staffed, highly educated workforce up here in Alaska. So we have to bear that in mind, that we're lucky to have those doctors here at all. In the lower 48, also, with managed care as vicious as it was during the 80s and 90s, reimbursement for physicians went down such that Medicare became an attractive payer. Up here, that never happened. And so clinicians can earn, can be well compensated up here. And that creates an uncomfortable gap where it becomes a choice for the physician to either do more complicated work and get paid less, or get paid more. So I'm sympathetic, sir, but that's the way the economics stack up.
And, you know, we're starting to come to the very end of this hour. It's come much too fast, and I feel like there are still so many aspects of this discussion still to be had. And I would just really like if, for just 1 minute each, if you could give me just some kind of advice for people who are just coming into the Medicare system really fast, like one piece of wisdom for people just entering the Medicare system.
Take good care of yourself, first off. Treat yourself well. Find a medical home as soon as you can, and be responsible in your care. You'll find much less struggle if you can take on more of the responsibility for your care.
Great. And Anne?
I guess one thing I would say would be to choose someone to make decisions for you when that time comes, if it comes, and talk with them about what's important to you.
Those are two really good words of advice. Well, more than two words, really. Again, this has been Hometown Alaska, and we've been discussing the issues of Medicare and patients trying to find proper care here in the Anchorage Bowl area. We do have these two new great clinics, one that's to open up, I believe, in the next month or so, as soon as they can be staffed, and the new one right over here at the Providence Medical Center. You can find links to all of these sites that we discussed today on our site, and that's at kska.org under Hometown Alaska. Additionally, you will also find some links to some shows that have happened prior to this one in the last week or so that have covered different aspects of the Medicare conundrum here in the state, everything from the fiscal aspect to the political aspect of it. There are also a couple of different sites that you will find on ours, links to them that will show you how to answer some of the questions that came up today from our callers. And again, that's on kska.org. This hour has come to an end. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Tom Hunt, the Chief Executive Officer for Physician Services at Providence, and Nurse Practitioner Dr. Anne Thrall of the Palliative Care Consultation Service at Providence, and to Jean Larson of the Medicare Information Office of Anchorage and Representative Les Guerra for joining us by phone. Next week, February 23rd, on Hometown Alaska, Kathleen McCoy will be discussing women's contributions to the state. Pat Yak is APTI Vice President of News and Public Media, and Ron Zastrow engineered today's program. Many thanks and welcomes to him today as well. Thank you for listening. I'm Tika Ballas.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music for Hometown Alaska is Lead Dog, composed and performed by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Views expressed on Hometown Alaska are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org, and CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.